Good. Welcome to the lecture on compact star physics. So the last time we were talking about a dipole model for pulsars. So there's a magnetic field which is off-axis compared to the rotation axis, and that rotating dipole, time-changing dipole, changes electromagnetic radiation. So the pulsar is losing energy and thereby slowing down. The other issue we discussed was that the pulsar might emit gravitational waves, thereby losing energy and slowing down. And when I wrote down the formula, I had an old value for the maximum amount of ellipticity, which was 3 times 10 to minus 4. And that was beaten now with new LIGO measurements. So that was the old value. There are newer ones on the maximum amount of ellipticity. So there has been some search for gravitational waves from pulsars. So this was done by the LIGO collaboration 2017. So this was part of the last run of LIGO on gravitational waves. And one thing is that you constrain the ellipticity. Ellipticity, this is basically the ratio of the equatorial axis to the perpendicular axis, epsilon. And as they have not seen any gravitational wave signal, they could constrain the ellipticity for the Krebs pulsar to a value which is smaller than 3 times 6 times 10 to minus 5, so an order of magnitude slower than before. And they did this also for other two. In fact, they had about 200 pulsars which they were scanning for. The Krebs and the Wähler pulsar are the most interesting ones. In fact, the Krebs is the most interesting one because it loses a lot of energy. It's a young pulsar, and a young pulsar is rotating fast and losing a lot of energy. And therefore, one could hope to find some gravitational wave. And the energy emitted in gravitational waves, energy loss in gravitational waves, was E dot. Basically, this is the luminosity in gravitational waves compared to the energy loss of the dipole. And that was seen to be smaller than about 2 times 10 to minus 3. So this, what they say in the publication is if the energy they are sensitive to in gravitational waves is smaller than the energy loss they see one has estimated for the dipole model or from the spin down. Actually, it's not a dipole model, it's the spin down. So they just see this from the spin down. How much the pulsar is losing energy from the spin down, so from losing rotational energy, and that is a well-determined quantity. Then they said they beat the spin down limit. Yeah. So this means basically 2 per mil at max can be emitted in gravitational waves, and basically 99.8% is emitted in electromagnetic radiation. 99.8% in electromagnetic waves, at least. But they hope that with the new upgrade, they will be more sensitive, and maybe eventually they will really find gravitational waves from a pulsar. We can relate that ellipticity also in the size of a mountain on a pulsar. So if you say the radius is at the order of 10 kilometers for a neutron star, and with that ellipticity, then epsilon times r, which is a measure of basically how high a mountain can be on a neutron star, is then at the order of, so we have 10 kilometers, so 10 to 4 meters, 10 to 4 meters times, say, 4 times 10 to minus 5. So this is about 40 centimeters. So this is the maximum mountain we can have on a Crab pulsar. For the Vela pulsar, it's an order of magnitude less. The limit is something like 10 to minus 4, so there it is a few meters. So this is about the size of a football, so not more than a football mountain can be on the Crab pulsar. However, for the other pulsars, which are spinning at a different rate, at a slower rate, one can get even higher constraints on the ellipticity. And the record is so far ellipticity must be smaller or equal about 1.3 times 10 to minus 8. So this is even three orders of magnitude less. So we're not talking about 4 centimeters. We're not talking about 4 millimeters, we're talking about something like a fraction of a millimeter. So, right, so epsilon times r is about 10 to 4 meters times 10 to minus 8. So this is 10 to minus 4 meters. So this is 0.1 millimeter. 0.1 millimeter is the maximum deviation from a perfect sphere for one of the pulsars. That's an older pulsar, spinning slowlier, and therefore they are more sensitive to the ellipticity. Yes. Good. So bad news for climbers. Bad news for rock climbers on a neutron star. Okay. Good. So now we continue and discuss the properties of pulsars, or more the properties of neutron stars. And what we're going to do is now we want to get an estimate on how can we measure the masses of pulsars. So has anybody an idea how one can measure the masses of stellar objects from your astronomy classes?
A strong déjà vu.
Yeah. Okay.
I feel like you asked this before, at the beginning of the semester.
Yeah. We have mass estimates of ordinary stars. There's a mass-luminosity relation, for example. There's a Hertzsprung-Russell diagram. We know that the blue stars are more massive than the other ones. Oh, we know the mass of our sun. So how did we know the mass of our sun, for example? We're looking at Keplerian orbits of the planets. So if we want to get a mass of a star, we have to look at binary systems. So another object is orbiting the other one, and from the Keplerian motion, we get the mass. So look at binaries. That's the magic thing. By the way, there's also one more thing. One can look also for massive objects by gravitational lensing, right? So if That would also count if you do not have a binary, but an isolated neutron star, if that is passing in front of a star. You see some, then the light is bent around the neutron star, so you see a sudden enhancement of the light. So the light of the star is constant, then the neutron star is passing in front of it, focusing the light beams, so there's an enhancement of the luminosity of the star and going back. And from that, from the height, you can infer that the mass of the neutron star. So far, this has not been achieved for a neutron star, but it has been achieved for a white dwarf. So one white dwarf has been measured by this method, very precisely, by the way. Yeah, question?
Depending on the rotation, would you notice a different peak when the neutron star is passing the star behind it? So you would get peak because if the luminosity is increasing, but if it rotates in the right direction, if it has passed the star, would you see another peak?
No, the lensing object is too small, so you don't see it. So that's not an effect. So the with that method, you cannot resolve the size of the neutron star of any other object or the size of the source, or even of a white dwarf or an ordinary star. It's hard to see. You can't resolve it. Okay, look at binaries, and then we're going back to textbooks on astronomy. How do you determine masses from binary systems? Looking at Keplerian law, so we look at Kepler's law. And we say that the period of the orbit is 4 pi squared divided by g times the sum of the two masses times the distance a to the third power. That's the famous third Kepler law. So for a binary, if we have so normally Kepler's law just has here the sun, the mass of the sun in here. So now we consider, okay, we have now two masses which might be even about equal sizes. So we have to take this into account in Kepler's law. And then we say that the orbital separation is the sum of the two orbital separations of mass 1 and mass 2. And this is given by the period over 2 pi times the sum of the two velocities. So the velocities are somehow defined by the period and the orbital distance. Okay. So in this sense, we get then the following, that we can look at the sum of the two masses. The sum of the two masses is then the period over 2 pi g times the two velocities to the third power. Good. Now the problem is, if we measure the velocities, what we normally measure is just the radial velocity, right? So that the star is moving like this, we don't see. But we can see radial movements just by the shift in spectral lines. We see there's some Doppler shift of spectral lines, so we can measure the radial velocity, right? So we need to project basically the velocity onto a plane which is perpendicular to the line of sight. Radial velocity, which we denote as VR. So we need to project on plane perpendicular to line of sight. Perpendicular to line of sight. Okay, so then we can do the following. So the sum of the two masses we want to determine. is given by the period over 2 pi g times the radial velocity. And now this is projected onto the plane, so it gives us a sine of this inclination angle, which is called I. I is then the inclination angle. Yeah, so that's the angle between the plane where the two masses are orbiting projected onto the line perpendicular to us. So that's the angle in between. Okay. Yeah, so that means if I is 0, we're looking face onto it. If I is 90 degrees, we're looking onto the plane. Okay, then we are pretty much done with getting the so-called mass function. We just need a center of mass relation in addition. So there's a center of mass relation. Yeah, we just makes a statement on how is the how are the two radii related to each other if I go to the center of mass system. This is basically where I define this period. Yeah, center of mass relation. And this is basically a definition of the center of mass system, right? So the ratio of the two masses corresponds to the inverse of the ratio of the distances to each other, and that is just given by the orbital distance a, right? So we can plug this one in, and then we're coming finally to the mass function. And this is how it is called. The mass function is, we have on one side all the masses we need, m1 plus m2 squared times the inclination angle. And then this is just given with the period of the binary system and the radial velocity of one system, which we can measure. And that's a crucial equation, just using Keplerian motion for any binary system. We can have two stars, a white dwarf and a black hole, you name it. Yeah? So for example, if you have a white dwarf and a black hole, we could only measure the radial velocity of the white dwarf. But we can infer somehow the mass of the black hole with that. And also for exoplanets, right, one does the same. Yeah.
What kind of role would relativistic corrections play in this case?
What's the role? Yeah, what's the role of relativistic corrections? So for white dwarfs and for ordinary stars, it's basically a very small effect. We know the compactness of a white dwarf is 10 to minus 4. So at most, we can expect effects from the level at 10 to minus 4 for relativistic effects. But for neutron stars, it's actually crucial. So this is how one determines the masses of neutron stars, by looking at corrections from general relativity. And that's exactly what we're going to explore. Right, so we can measure these two values we can measure from the pulsars. From the pulsar timing of arrival, we can also measure somehow also the radial velocity. And the pulsar is emitting a pulse from here, then it's moving back from us, emitting pulses from here, so there will be a time delay in the signatures, in the pulses. Then it comes back to us. So we can measure the radial velocity. We know the period, how long it takes to make an orbit from measuring this Kepler orbit from the pulses of the pulsar. So we know that one. Still, we can't really resolve the mass m1 for the pulsar. We need to know maybe the companion mass. Then we could solve for the mass of the pulsar, but then we're still lacking the inclination angle. Yeah. So sometimes one makes estimate about the companion star. If one knows that's a blue giant and is an OB star or a B star with a certain classification, one can make a rough estimate of the mass of the star and then gets the mass of the pulsar. But that's not a precise measurement. That's maybe more or less a guess. You still need to know the inclination angle. You have to make a guess for the inclination angle. So sometimes people are doing that. But we are smarter than that. We are using GR. So we have still three unknowns. We have three unknowns. We need to have two more constraints to fix everything. Yeah. So need two more constraints, two more measurements. To fix M1, M2, and sine of the inclination angle. Good. Okay. And to lowest order, there are 1, 2, 3, 4. There are four effects, and in total we have five possible measurements from GR. Five additional parameters. Which we can measure, but we only need two. Then we have everything. So that's the task. Now you need to wait long enough to see there's a deviation from Kepler's law, and that deviation is given by a certain parameter from GR, and with that we can infer the mass and the radius. So first thing is the Einstein time delay. Einstein time delay for weak fields. We always assume weak fields. We have still weak fields. So that even if we have two neutron stars, there's some orbital separation which is much larger than 10 kilometers. So we're talking about fields at the order of 10 to minus 3 or so, maybe 10 to minus 2 at max, but it's still small. It's not on the order of 1. If you are close to the surface of a neutron star, of course, then we have a 10% effect. Or even more. So Einstein time delay is basically the fact that the clocks for the pulsar are ticking different than the clocks on Earth. So it's the different clocks. Yeah, so that means that we have one clock which we call capital T, and we have one clock which is running, which is just given by the coordinate, small t, when the signal is emitted, and 1 minus 2 phi dx squared. This is for weak fields, right? This is the metric for weak fields. This is the gravitational form of the metric, 1 plus 2 phi, 1 minus 2 phi. Yeah, and this is really the proper time, which is measurable, and this is just the coordinate time, which is not a physical measurable thing. But we can relate those two times. This is basically a coordinate time, but we can recast that into the following form. There's a mismatch between these two times. We can divide by dt, small t, and take the square root of that. And then this is given by 1 plus phi. Here we just make a Taylor expansion and replace the square root of that one is approximately 1 plus phi. So let's make it like this. And here we get, we forget this factor, we get a dx squared over dt squared. This is the velocity squared. And then from the square root, we get a half v squared, if I'm not mistaken, 1 minus 2 phi. 1 minus 2 phi. So this is from the Doppler effect. This is the gravitational potential effect. Right? So this is the gravitational redshift. So when a line is when we have lines within a gravitational field and in a moving object, there will be two effects, one from the gravitational potential and the other one from the relative movement of the object to us. And these are just the two effects for the Einstein time delay. Okay, and then one can calculate that effect within GR. So what is going to happen? We have some, if one discusses Keplerian orbits, there's also called something like the eccentric anomaly. So we said R is equal A times 1 plus E, where this is now the eccentricity, not the ellipticity, cosine u, and then one arrives at that the local coordinate time is the proper time plus a shift from the Einstein effect, and that Einstein effect is for Keplerian orbits is given like gamma sine u. Yeah, so you measure basically. You can measure the radius as a function of time. Yeah. You can relate this to u as a function of time. You measure sine u. You measure this change in the timing of arrival due to the Einstein time delay. And then you determine that coefficient. That's the way. And that gamma is now a gamma, a function of the masses of the star and also of the inclination angle. Yeah, the ellipticity. No, it's just a function of the. Yeah. So by determining that parameter here, the Einstein time delay parameter gamma, we have a constraint on the two masses. That's how it goes. U is called the eccentric anomaly. Just some variable. It goes under this funny name. You just recast the radius with a new coordinate, which is defined implicitly like with that relation, cosine u. And then this Einstein effect for Keplerian orbits can be then rewritten in this form as a function of sine u. And the prefactor is the Einstein factor, the Einstein time delay factor. Yeah, so basically, you have five parameters which give you deviations from GR for Keplerian orbits. And the first one is this Einstein parameter. So gamma is called the Einstein parameter. Or Einstein delay parameter. So you get some oscillating functions because of the orbit, and then you fit this oscillating function with the sine u, and the prefactor gives you the gamma. Right? So in all these, I mean, this is just a heuristic motivation, what's going to happen, and then you have to do a more detailed calculation, and then you find this very excessive equation. Yeah. It's of both. So I can write down.
What is then the radius?
Pardon me?
What is the radius?
What do you mean, what is the radius?
Is it the radius of one orbiting radius?
No, it's the radius between the two masses.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And A is the orbital distance, if you look at the orbits, A of T. So gamma is, and that you just need to solve now the Keplerian motion with including with GR. You get this correction factor. It goes G over the period, where the period is now the binary period, okay, as before. It's not the period of the pulsar. So it's M2, the sum of the two masses times the ellipticity, A M1 plus M2. And that's it. So now one can also replace, I mean, you can replace that one. You can replace that one also with the other relations we had before. Do I need to do this? No, I leave it like that. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, there's a power missing.
What is it? The reduced mass, which first the product and divided by the sum of the masses?
No, this is a 1/3 or so. This must be a 1/3 because later on we can replace it with a G 3/2 M2. M1 plus M2 epsilon divided by M1 plus M2 to the 4/3 times the period over 2 pi. Yeah, I have to check this, why this has not been cancelled out in the final expression. This is funny. Okay. Yeah, question? Yeah, you have this capillary in elliptic orbits. But of course, due to GR, you will have other effects, some deviations from this capillarian elliptic orbit, which you can see. And in addition, you have, for example, the periastron advance. So if you look at the orbits, they are not closed, right? So the orbits are not closed, actually, like this. So if you have one star orbiting the other one, it actually doesn't go like this, if you go to the proper frame, but it's open, so it goes like this. Yeah, so this node here, this node is changing. And that's the periastron advance, or aphelion advance. The point of closest approach is changing within the system. And that's what we know for Mercury. Mercury, this is happening because of the gravitational field of Jupiter, but there's also a small correction from GR. And that was one of the first tests of GR. This is also happening for pulsars, but the effect, of course, is much more pronounced, orders of magnitude pronounced. So you don't have to wait centuries to see a small effect. You see it within a few days or so. Any other question? So the next one is Shapiro time delay. Yeah, Einstein was about the different clocks for the pulsar. So compared to the outside observer, they're basically the reference frame of the pulsar has different times locally compared to our time system. But here we're talking about other things that photons travel in a gravitational potential. In gravitational potential. And thereby they experience a time delay. And that time delay, now we can just use this one again. dt is plus minus 1 minus 2 phi dx, right? Because ds squared is 0, photons travel on time-like trajectories, not on time, on null trajectories. So they have this there's this relation between the time and the spatial coordinate x for photons in a gravitational potential given by phi in the weak field limit again. So there's a time delay. So time delay, delta S, delta index S for Shapiro, which is minus 2. We integrate the potential along the path of the light going outwards. Yeah. And then if you compute this within the GR, within the orbits in GR, you find then that it depends on two parameters. So one parameter is R. That's a bit unfortunate, but that's a historic notation. That's the range parameter. And that goes with the logarithm of 1 minus e cosine u minus s, and s is the shape parameter. S times, and then there's some function on sine omega. This is the periastron. Times cosine u minus e, and then there's another factor, 1 minus e squared, and it goes like cosine omega sine u, and then I have to close all the brackets, and this one also. Okay. We still need the connection to the masses. Now there's some prediction how this parameter should look like. And that is actually less awkward than the other relations we had before. So the range parameter R is just G times M2. Right? Of course, when I emit a photon from M1, it goes through the gravitational potential of M2. So it only depends on M2. That's the depth of the gravitational potential the photon has to go through, basically. And the shape parameter S is just the shape of the curve and just given by the inclination angle. So by measuring the Shapiro delay alone, we can determine two quantities, and then we can infer the mass of the pulsar M1 by using the mass function, which I unfortunately have erased. By looking at a mass function, and then everything is determined. And that was happening in one case. Actually, the first super heavy pulsar they have seen in 2010, they measured the Shapiro delay, and they had a very strong signal in the Shapiro delay. So this was enough. So they just measured R and S, and then they had a mass of the pulsar to a very high position. It's only mechanics which is going on in here. Just Keplerian motion plus corrections from GR, nothing else. You just have this regular pulses of your test pulsar, so it gives you immediately the Keplerian orbit plus the correction, so you can determine everything. There are two more things how to measure the mass of the pulsar. One is gravitational wave emission. That is the next one. Basically, you have a loss of energy, so the two neutron stars are coming closer to each other. You see a change in the period P. So, yeah, this is the only effect which makes the binary period higher. No, smaller. Smaller, it's a negative sign. And again, it's a function of M1 and M2. Shall I write down the expression?
Yeah, maybe, why not?
Minus 192 pi over 5 g to the 5/3 M1 M2 M1 plus M2 to the 1/3, and then the period 2 pi over pb to the power of 5/3. And there's a correction function from the ellipticity, which is some polynomial and yeah, some powers. This is just from the fact that you have not a circular orbit, but an elliptical orbit. There's some correction factor, which is known, which is some function of the ellipticity. Okay, so if you measure that one, we can also determine the masses, the ratio of the masses. And the last one is the periosteron advance. And this is omega dot. So the omega which appears here is actually the location of the periosteron. Omega, where's omega? Here. In angle. That's the usual historically motivated way how to describe capillary motions. So it's not really the usual omega you're used to. So it's 2 pi over p, 3 gm over a times 1 minus e squared. And yeah, where m is now the sum of the two masses, can be constrained by that. Okay, and the nice thing is one can do something else. One can test GR. So for example, you have a pulsar orbiting a neutron star, so you have really strong, the strongest gravitational potential you can imagine. And then you do not only measure two parameters, but you measure three. Then the system is overdetermined, and you can check whether the predictions from GR are right. Or if you measure all five, even better. And this has been achieved with a double pulsar. Double pulsar, one has measured all five parameters, so one measured gamma, R, S, omega dot, and P dot measured. Yeah, so if you determine two, the other ones are basically given by GR. You can check for it. And it turns out that GR is correct up to 1%. Up to a few percent. I think it was even less. I will quote the numbers the next time, the more precise one. Okay, good. So, one can then also make a plot where one can plot the two masses and then draw lines of regions where the Shapiro delay gives a constraint on the two masses. This is the screen curve. Then another one on periosteron advance, another one on the range parameter, on the Einstein parameter gamma. And here we have P dot. And they all have to merge basically in the same spot in the two mass diagram. And it does actually. So this is a zoom out, and it fits actually perfectly well. So the mass is within the range of, we are talking about 1.123, 10 to minus 3. 10 to minus 3. So, good. Are there any questions about how do you determine the masses of pulsars? Very often, if people are asking how to really know the mass of the pulsar, you have to make so many assumptions. We don't only have to make one assumption. The orbit fulfills general relativity. That's it. Okay. So See you next time.